Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, you beautiful people. So much to discuss today.
Justin Robert Young.
Yeah, what's up, world?
Gentlemen, I'll tell you what's up. You know what's up? What's up?
What's up?
I'm going to invite you on a beautiful balloon ride.
Oh, man, what could be more delightful, whimsical, and fun?
I love balloon rides, man. They're the best.
I mean, this isn't one of those balloon rides where it's technically possible for us to fall to our deaths, is it?
Well, Brian, it's technically possible for you to fall from your death anywhere, sitting in your chair right now.
Oh, well, fair. In that case, yeah. It might as well be way up in the air in a beautiful balloon.
All right, now we got room. There is a very hilarious Dave Chappelle joke about a balloon basket, which is very funny. And I'll refer you to the go, if you know what I'm talking about.
Ta-ta.
Yeah. There's room in this balloon for 14 other people. Who else are we going to bring in this balloon? Who else do we want to have come on our balloon ride?
Okay, now, is this a arc balloon or a jaunty afternoon balloon?
Jaunty afternoon balloon, if I know what that means.
Okay, well,
Brian's wife and children immediately.
Goodness. Hold on. He said it was a jaunty afternoon. I'm not taking them. No way. I'm going to take, and I get to invite anybody?
Yeah.
Former President Barack Obama.
Cool. Barry's on board.
Barry Obama.
Who else is on board?
I'm going to invite Brian's family. So all of Brian's family is on
board. But they have to stay on the other side of the basket for me, which means I also get to invite Jimmy Carter, the ghost of Ronald Reagan, George Bush.
Cool. So we're all on our balloon ride. We're going up. You know what? And we're going to go do this in Orlando. It's nice and flat. You can kind of like see for miles and miles and miles.
Sure. That makes sense.
Yeah, beautiful. That famous Orlando skyline.
Mm-hmm. Flat. You know what? What could possibly go wrong?
Nothing could go wrong. It'll be great.
We have 14 people, including one ghost of a president.
16 of us. Two plus are the people we invited.
16 of us. Okay.
Former heads of state. Brian invited them all.
I'm gonna have to invite a bunch of other ghosts, or maybe our current president.
Let's play a game. What would be the worst thing that could happen?
I mean,
other than just outright dying.
Getting struck by lightning? Bird strike.
The worst thing that can happen is we never come down, right?
Is that the worst thing? Is that the worst thing?
I mean, eventually, when you start to death.
Dying?
It's like the Fifth Dimension song, up, up, and away in a beautiful balloon, you know? It's flying forever.
Or the Prodigy version.
Hurry up. Amazon flying drone, deliver us some food.
But don't get so close that you sever, you cut down our balloon.
So let's think of things that go wrong. Lightning would be bad. Lightning not be fun. Never coming back down.
Temperature. If it's temperate when you leave and then suddenly not temperate, that would be unpleasant.
Okay. Any of you ever been up in like a balloon?
I went when I was in second grade. If you bought a...
That was a dream, Brian. That never happened.
No. Well, first of all, you're probably right. But I do have a memory of being in Colorado and at a Christmas tree sale. And if you bought a Christmas tree, you got
with
to
He-Man.
Go, you got to go up for a little bit in a hot air balloon.
What but it a was weird only promotion. Like,
yeah, it was. It was.
It's like this guy's Christmas tree farm and his wife, if you got to help my brother, you got to help. He's got the hot air balloon. You know, we've been sitting in the garage. What are we going to, like, what am I supposed to do? Give free hot air balloons to everybody who buys a Christmas tree?
I mean, that's kind of what happened. I mean, to be honest, that's fairly efficient because it wouldn't cost much to go up 100 yards in a balloon and then come down. I mean, what is that, 30 cents of fuel that you got to fire? Whatever.
We'll put out a spreadsheet on it. So let's see. I went up. I went to San Diego once, driving to San Diego, the animal park there, and I'm with Mary Jarrus, you know Mary. And we're driving along, and I look off in the distance, and I see a big silver
Real quick, when you say the animal park, do you mean the world famous San Diego Zoo, number one conservatory of pandas?
Yeah, that and the safari park. So we're driving along, and I look out there, and I see a big silver floating sphere. I'm like, UFOs are real, folks. I'm like, UFOs are real. I'm looking at a UFO. Clearly, it's a UFO. It's giant silver floating sphere. I'm like, and I'm one of these things. I'm like, well, this is going to be interesting because I have no idea what I'm looking at, you know. But it seems odd.
Can I tell you my previous experience was, of all the different airlines, there's one that has a distinctive design, which is American Airlines, in that they do the polished aluminum sides or whatever. And if the sun is behind you and setting and a plane comes in, it does not appear to be, even if it's sideways, it does not appear as a plane. But instead, all you can see is that thin, bright orange line from head to fuselage to tail that floats there, and it looks for all the world like a floating disc. So given that that's the case, like, there was definitely a couple of times I looked over and I was like, what? Oh, wait, it's a plane. But that was hot for a moment.
This was a sphere. This was like full on sphere.
Full on, you know, circle. Like.
Yeah. Not, yeah. I'm like, all right, well, this is going to be interesting. You know, we get closer, and it was what it was. And what they have there is they have a helium balloon that they do these in some attractions now. It's a helium balloon that's cabled to the ground. You get into this gondola that's underneath it, this round part, and they raise you up, in this case, like several hundred feet up above the animal park. So what it is, they actually have these in attractions now. They're helium balloons. There's closed helium balloons. The gondola's underneath. They're cabled there. You get in, you ride up, and you go back down. It's very cool. This was not that. This is a hot air balloon over Orlando, right? So you're in a hot air balloon. Brian invited everybody. And
also for the record, like Florida is I think it's safe to say, hands down, the most consistently meteorologically turbulent area of the entire United States.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I know because I know that you have places, let's say, going over the Rockies and stuff. I don't. I would say that, like, weather certainly changes. Like, I don't.
There was some. There
was
some kind of statistical thing to Tampa, the west coast of Florida, having more lightning strikes, which is why the hockey team is named.
Oh yeah, we have more lightning. Like, that's crazy. So now we're up in a balloon, and all of a sudden, Brian had decided to maybe test out his drone. We don't know.
I was huffing nitrous oxide in the corner just by myself.
And then pop the cylinder. All of a sudden, we got a balloon leak. Our balloon is starting to crash.
It doesn't seem.
Oh, no.
It's a slow crash. By the way, I was a witness to when one of the Goodyear blimps crashed.
What?
Oh, yeah. I didn't tell you this. This is several years ago. I'm driving along. It's in Florida. I'm driving along. I look up in the sky, and I see this Goodyear blimp going, like, in this sort of weird spiraling motion down towards the ground. I'm like, that does not look good. And I see this, but it was a slow crash. I run home. I get my Canon XO1 camera. I go back to where this was. And there's news crews everywhere over there. I pull up. I call my camera up there. And somebody goes, oh, news crews, you go stand over here. I'm like, yeah, sure. Okay. And so I get corralled over with other media. You know, I just showed up there like, all right, we're going to take you in now. I'm like, okay, they take us in, and it was into this, like, this public storage facility, and the pilot had brought it down, found a spot to bring it out, brought it into this public storage facility, and there was this huge, just deflated Goodyear blimp just laying over all the buildings and stuff.
Oh, God.
You know, we get in there, I'm like, well, this is really cool. I guess you should pretend to record this. And I'm like, well, I guess just to clean it up, they're just going to bring in X-Acto blades or something. But it was a very interesting, surreal experience to see what it's like behind the scenes at things like that. Because, like, you know, the media, we're here right now. It's like, yeah, you waited over there for 45 minutes with other people in the media talking about what was going on. Somebody told you, we're going to bring you in, we're going to do this. And you didn't record that because it's just the pre-brief. You know, news is kind of fake. But anyhow, we're in our own balloon and we're about to crash. What's the worst that could happen? What's the worst that could happen on this balloon trip? Or is it going to be fine?
I mean, okay, when you say crash, how dire does the situation seem?
And it's a slow thing, but we're kind of going,
But like, are we worried about breaking our bones when we collide with the ground?
Or? I don't think we're worried about breaking bones. Fortunately, the pilot's going to bring it towards a pond.
Oh, and that seems safe, right? We can all swim here, except for the ghost of Ronald Reagan.
Yeah. So it turned out everything was fine. there was one little caveat.
One little thing.
Florida.
Oh my God!
Wait, if we're in a pond, you are joking.
So let me describe this to you.
Okay,
a hot air balloon made this is from the Fox 35. A hot air balloon made a water landing in a retention pond near Walt Disney World on Monday. Be like, yay, Disney! What if we crashed inside of there? The pilot was attempting to land in a nearby field, but never made it. A rioter, Sebastian Westbury, said there were 16 people on board, including Barack Obama. In addition, the pilot, went down around 8 a.m. It touched the water, and he was like, just stand up. It's going to be fine. At first, it was smiles and laughter, but a short while later, there were screams as the passengers began to panic. The balloon tilted, the basket tilted, people got underneath the plastic, and that's when it got serious. Fortunately, everybody got out of the water, and there were injuries, however, one child was transported. And that's when they looked back, and they realized this was a alligator-infested pond.
Oh, I knew it!
Oh my God!
Okay, well, first of all, the alligator thing. This is not going to be interesting to anyone but Florida, but, like, what are the odds, Justin, that given any body of water you look at, there's an alligator within 100 meters?
In the right areas of Florida, you know, those that are effectively repercussed marshland, like you're gonna get some gators, man. Like it was their land before it was ours.
And yes, you should be afraid of gators. Don't mess with them or whatever. But also, I think as both of us as individuals who have spent time in the water with gators, you know, that's not the part that scares me. The part that terrifies me, and the part that I want to just reach out and throttle you for inviting my family onto this weird thing scenario, is that panic thing. Because if I picture myself in a hot air balloon going down, and it's me and a bunch of strangers, I have very little fear. It's like I'm either going to swim out or I'm not, and I'm not overly worried one way or the other, right? Like, you know. A hilarious magician
because you are in a group of strangers, you are looking out for number one.
So that's all that exists, right? I mean, it's like that's all there is. But
it's bad time to announce that we're going to be doing the official Weird Things balloon ride escapade now.
Just so you know, if this thing goes down, don't be looking to Brushwood for help.
Okay, unless you invite my family.
Brian's calling a one-person Uber. As it's descending, so we can hit the waves.
When I picture this same scenario with any number of family members, it becomes absolutely horrifying. Like I just become abjectly terrified about what I would think in that moment.
Because now your problem is calming everybody down to the point where you could get from one point to the other,
right? So think about it. Like on the one hand, like my first thing is to calm Bonnie down and make sure, like I have to assess whether or not I have a lieutenant who is on the same plan as I am. Then we have to divvy up the children by responsibility. And I find myself in the weird moment of like, who do I trust? Like, do I trust Penny to get out on her own? This is harsh.
How long would it take me to remarry? How long would it take me to have more kids?
How long is it unseemly before I start dating again?
What's that number for vasectomy reversal again? 5713 reverse.
Did I pay the hot balloon operator before, or I still need to pay him for
it's a very interesting thing.
I pull out my wallet and I shout, here's your tip, and I throw it at his face knowing that it doesn't matter. I grab the youngest. I say, Bonnie, grab the second youngest. I say, oldest one, you're on your own, and we all dive out.
Report cards out.
I'm like, and then as I go down, I shout, I'm sorry, Barack Obama.
Yeah, like who am I gonna have to pay tuition for the most? That's horrible. It's horrible. But there is a thing. I talk to all friends when my dudes buddies have like kids. First, they go through this period where like, man, like, yeah, my wife is fat. And then like, yes, there's this alien in my house. And then the moment hits and it always happens. I'm like, just wait for it. It's like, I would die for this thing. You know, there's like this change that happens where you're like, Yeah, okay. I'm involved in this thing. I guess something happened then. Just something, the chemistry kicks in, the biology kicks in, and all of a sudden you're like, okay, my purpose now is to make sure this thing survives no matter what. Whatever the inconvenience, it's irrelevant. One job is to make sure this thing continues.
It is really, really amazing because I got a few friends back home in Florida, and one of them is quite possibly, I think, the most selfish person that I have ever met in my entire life. And that is saying
I'm flattered that you know me and it's not me.
Oh, no. Believe you me. And yet, you know, even though he has had problems with the mom, the love for the kid is something that I've never seen in him at all before about anything. It really is remarkable.
Yeah, it is fascinating how that happens.
So before we move on, like, this idea of crashing with family or whatever was made very, very real to me because one of our locations to family vacation is down at South Padre Island. Like many islands, it's, you know, this isthmus or isthmus would be attached. It's a long, skinny island right off the coast of the very bottom of Texas. And you have to drive this giant bridge over. And apparently one of the sections of the bridge had fallen out. But this was at night. So the people who came up after it were just, you know, hey, kids, we're driving to South Padre Island. They got up and just went over a cliff and never knew it. And then smack hit the water. You know, who knows whether, you know, what angle or whatever. And at that moment, it's just nothing but blackness and 60 degree water coming in all around. So, I mean, it's like that was a weird moment to drive over that bridge shortly after they had made those repairs.
It's scary. Those are the things you just don't see. Hey. But you know what you can see coming? Is your support for our Patreon.
Oh, my God.
Absolutely. Yeah, patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can support this very, very program. Head on over there right now and kick us in a couple of schmeckles because that is how we keep this show going each and every week, even when we got to delay it a couple days like we did today. So thank you to everybody who continues to make this show a reality.
Yeah. Much appreciated.
Real quick, Alex Cutadine in the chat says, Jesus, does Brian just sit around thinking about ways his family might perish? Yes, it's called being a responsible patriarch. This is what it means to captain a vessel, is you're constantly thinking about what might imperil the vessel.
You know, and this show became a way to exploit that in many ways with these scenarios.
I was going to say that also we started mining it for cash. So so that's our thing.
So a little bit of show and tell before the show. I was showing you guys an app that I made that, what it was is what I wanted to do. And I'm going to give the backstory is I wanted to come up with an easier way to do voice dictation. Cause the problem of trying to do computer voice dictation is you have to spell out your punctuation, which if you have this dream as a writer, like, I'd love to just be able to talk to my computer and tell a story. And it's not like that. Cause you have to say, spell out your punctuation, new paragraph, you have to do quotes and all that. You will spend, you know, I've looked at it like you spend, you know, probably 30% or 40% of the syllables you uttered, you know, ends up being spelling or excuse me, rather ends up being punctuation. And I thought, could there be a way to improve upon that using some very simple rules? So I started off, I built a little app on my computer that went through and I took books like passages from John Grisham books, J.K. Rowling, et cetera. And I looked in books when in book text is different than regular speech. But I looked for examples to figure out what were the most common placements for paragraphs or for punctuation, for questions, things like this. And I tried to come up with some very simple rules to do this. And I found some really cool things built into the OS system, the Apple OS system based on like this natural language processing, which were ways to tell me what was nouns and pronouns, et cetera, found some simple rules that could do. And so then I built an app, and the app is called StoryVoice. And what it does is it allows you to actually just say a sentence. It tries to guess if it's a question or a statement, and it does the appropriate punctuation. And then if you said, like, he said, it puts in, you know, I'll give you an example here. Let's do a new one. Why did you do this? Asked Brian.
As it is listed on the phone, it says, quote, why did you do this? Question mark. Asked Brian. That's amazing. Right.
So you can go back and forth and do dialogue. You can do open dialogue and go back and forth. I can have a conversation. I can either have so-and-so says this. So I put in all sorts of attributions, said, reply, did this. It can figure out if it starts at the beginning or the end. And then also if I do, if you're doing dialogue where it's multiple sentences, this is very interesting, but stupid. Why did you waste your time doing this? Asked Justin. Okay. It did. It went ask instead of ask. That's not me. Sure, that's sure, the voice recognition. But
I'll be damned if it doesn't say as it comes into focus. Yeah, quote,
this is very
why
interesting,
did you do this?
But stupid. Why did you waste your time doing this? Question mark. Asked Justin. That's amazing because, again, it does not know that this is a quote until you get to the end. And yet what it spits out is something that you would normally have to do. Quote, why did you ask this? Period, space, you know.
So I put some shortcuts in there too where you can just say dialogue on, and then you don't have to keep attributing it back and forth. And anyway, I'm going to be testing this. If anybody wants to try this, just email me at amy@gmail.com. It's iOS only, so it's for iPhone only because of just the language processing system that's built in there. And I want to get into that for a moment because it's not actually plugged for this yet. But I'm excited about this because I was able to make this. You know, I was able to use this because of the tools. We're in a really cool phase right now. You know, I've been playing around with some stuff using Google's machine learning and their visual systems and stuff. And I played with the AR kit, which we talked about in a previous episode. I actually got AR kit up and running, and very, very cool. Use the demos where you're looking into your phone and you see the objects floating in space. And then I tried it with the Unity, et cetera. And then I started digging around in some other things that's inside of, you know, what they're putting. And again, what's coming out on iOS, there's going to be Android versions and all this. So I don't want it to make it be like, I'm just Apple fanboy here. This is where the technology is going. So I was able using and few lines of code, I was able to grab, you know, a natural language processing system that could break things down into nouns, pronouns, et cetera, and then build the system out there. I had to create my own rules and stuff, et cetera, but I could actually use the machine to tell me what those words were. There's also a new thing they've added to iOS, which is a service like their versions of this elsewhere out there, but now it's natively built into it, and it's machine learning. And what machine learning is, that's basically how you tell things apart. It's how it knows, let's say, who, you know, recognizes your face versus your friends' faces in your photo albums. You can do really cool things with machine learning, such as you could build apps that could recognize your cat and not somebody else. That's not the most practical thing in the world. you know, you could do all sorts of really cool things there where you can use machine learning to give it large groups of data, and it will use artificial intelligence to figure out what one thing is and what something else is. It is very, very fascinating to all these tools that are available now that are exposed to the programmer level. So I could go in there and I made a tool that went in there and used, you know, basic machine learning to figure out what parts of speech were, et cetera. And so we're going to see a lot of cool stuff,
The one that blew me away over the weekend was, did you guys see the Portal to Another Dimension demo?
Oh, yeah. The AR thing. Yeah.
You know what? I did not actually see the demo, so we could watch it right now. But it's like I saw the conceit of it was similar to not unlike a certain Dark Tower movie about to come out, the idea of doors into another reality. Wow, that's fantastic.
But so it's one of those things that, you know, this was the first time that I kind of really thought of ARKit kind of like magic in the way that you think of a magic trick where the principles are all there. It's just the people that think through the curve and realize, oh, no, you can do this with this. And this was one of those first times where I just looked at a demo and I'm like, oh, wow. Like there is just so much here. And you can tell that this AR thing is kind of catching on.
Tell because people what you're seeing to our audio listeners.
So effectively, there is a a door in the middle of an alley, right? And
by the way, everything is just as seen by the camera. It appears to be a real life human street up and down the way.
Yeah. And yet inside is this obviously animated jungle world that once he steps through this passageway, now all of a sudden it is the door showing reality on the other side of it and the animated world that he is walking through. And then he walks right back out. I'm assuming it's a he because I'm misogynist.
I mean, 10 years? 10 years, this will be the experience inside our eyes, right? Within 10 years, I think there'll be some kind of version of the Vive that you could pretty much wear out in public.
I think you'll have hollowed out
goggle eyes, but
whoa. I think what's interesting is just seeing what we're going to get in 10 weeks, like what we're going to get in 10 months, you know, with just this stuff in our hands, because what is happening now just with the devs. I mean, I can't remember the last time that something at this phase of development was kind of as just kind of surface level visually exciting.
Here's my prediction. This is running like I did the demos. Like I did that thing you saw. Like I have set up on my iPad. I don't know what demo I have right now here. I've got about like four different things here of like doing some like AR tests and stuff. You can run this on stuff that's been around for, oh yeah. So like I was just playing around with just doing a, wanted to take it outside.
We're looking at Andrew, holding up a window into an outdoor universe right in front of his face.
So anyhow, it's like that. Those tools are there. My predictions is Apple put in AR kit. They put this in there, and they, again, remember it works with existing hardware, which means they've been working on this for a while. Because they're going to come up with, and this is the rumor is Apple's going to come out with their AR glasses. That's the goal. And it's clearly because you look at this, you go like, you say like, I want this in front of my face. I don't think we're talking several years. I think we're talking within 12 months, we're going to see a product because they put this out there for developers to develop the apps for this. This system will work with, if you had this, if you could right now, I could put that onto my phone and I could put that into a Google Cardboard and let the camera open.
Sure.
And I could use, I have real time tracking just like you do with like, you know, the lighthouse you do for Vive. I don't know what the delays are or whatever, but there's data. The tracking seems spot on when I just hold it up and look close. But the point is you could take an existing iPhone, put it into, you know, a 3D viewer and have that experience right now.
By the way, this was foretold as so many other wonderful things in Neal Stephenson's amazing book Snow Crash, specifically the cultural nuance of being the jerk who is constantly plugged in to the metaverse instead of being present with other people. They call them gargoyles. So it's like if you saw somebody who had their eyes obstructed with some kind of gizmo or whatever, you just assumed, friggin' gargoyles, these guys. And yet even in that construct, as it will most certainly be in real life, being a gargoyle is about the most punk rock thing you can do. You're saying to the physical world around you, I don't give two craps about who you are or what you look like or what you're doing. I am more interested in what's important to me. And I got to tell you, man, I'm with you on this. I think the timeline's going to be a lot shorter than anybody dares think.
Well, I think that was, you know, I'm going to bring it back to, remember that Google Glass demo? You know, the first time they showed it, and they're jumping out of a hot air balloon, skydiving, landing, and you're looking through this viewpoint and you see this display in the corner and this. And I'm thinking, I was at a point, I'm like, yes, augmented reality is here. Google Glass is the most awesome thing in the world. And then you're like, wait, that's not it. This is just a little thing there.
It's just a webcam duct taped to a pair of glasses.
Yeah, and then we got, you know, it was a great demo. Then we got, you know, HoloVision. You're like, yes, I'll put this on my face. I don't care what anybody thinks. Like, I get this little thing, this little tiny window in front of me here, you know. I would say that the Apple is always – Apple looks at what everybody else has done, and Apple will say – watch somebody else go into a market and go, nope, not ready. Tablets, phones, things like that. You know, and they're not you know, the first, they're usually the ones that were, they're probably the ones who time it right when the tech is right. Yeah. We've talked about this before about where the hardware, where look at Moore's law as far as processor speeds, things like this. We're at this wonderful point right now where ARKit surprised everybody because of the ability to, you know, its ability to track. And what they do is they do several cool things. When you load up one of the demos in there, as you see, it's using accelerometer data and all that, but then it uses a visual system to find flat surfaces, and it'll draw these rectangles in visually over where, like, flat surface here, flat surface here, flat surface here. And it's incredible because I'll walk into your room, you get the, it'll put an object in the room, you walk all the way into another room away from where you started, and you can still see the object because it puts it over the screen. But it's amazing how you can go 30 feet away and it still keeps track of what's going on. And
I'll
it builds this map.
So, tell me, which do you think is the bigger influence? Is technology finally allowing us to have video game style overlays? Because, like, for example, the experience of walking out of a room but seeing where something is, you know, through the walls, that's a fairly common trope in a number of video games, including like Left 4 Dead. So here's my question. When I think about the military, when I think about, war gaming and stuff, it seems to me that there's a curious relationship that so many of the video game elements end up showing up in real life. Which one is affecting the other? Is this us projecting what we wish our heads-up display in battle would look like, and therefore it shows up in a video game? Or is this a generation raised on video games with a heads-up display and therefore says this would be very helpful in a theater of battle?
I would say that sometimes it could be both, is that you have to have a starting point. And so much of, like, Pentagon and defense industry spending on speculative stuff comes from people who you sell generals on, this is the future, just like this. Your soldiers already play video games. Now we're going to give them this tech that's like this. And then you start with these modalities, and then maybe the modality works and we're fine with it, or the modality changes over time and you say we need something different. You know, there was, you know, we're at the 10-year anniversary of the iPhone, and the thing that we take for granted is that we're so used to our devices where we touch the screen, we move things around, we don't even think about the fact that 10 years ago that was novel. That was a novel thing, that the interface for your phone would be the entire screen, that there was
My favorite moment of the initial iPhone demo is the, like, Beatlemania reaction that Steve Jobs gets when he flicks the menu for the first time, because we had been so conditioned that everything was just a button that you press that brings up a new static menu. But the idea that you could just flick and all of a sudden it would roll was just watch that demo. I'm sure it's going to get a lot of play with the 10-year anniversary coming up.
Smoothly. And that was one of the things, too, is Apple said it's not enough that this action has to move this. It has to feel real time. The refresh rate has to be fast. And that was the problem early Android had. There was this layer there, whatever. And so there was a catch-up things, and now they're great. But there was a catch-up period where other devices, because Apple said, we need to put this at the core level, at the very, very deep down. So when you touch something and move it, it moves with your finger. And that's a thing that many people are like, what's a millisecond delay? Now we notice the big difference. It's an amazing sort of point. But as far as, you know, I think we're going to see, I think within a year, maybe sooner, I think we're going to see hardware. We're going to see some sort of either augmented reality glasses, whether or not it'll be standalone or something that works with your phone. I'm not sure, but the hardware is there. And this works. This is ARKit's backwards compatible to like iPhone 6 or whatever. So it's cool because it also means that you know, there was Google had their project for room sensing, but it was separate standalone hardware, which means, now that we've said, you can do it all on a phone, we're going to, if an iPhone 6 can do this, I'm sure that shipping versions of Android phones should be able to do this too with their own software development. So,
yeah. Well, and that's why I think your prediction is prescient, Andrew, that if they're looking at generations old hardware, then how small in a dedicated product, how small can they make that chipset and all the hardware that needs to go around it to create something like that? That would be in a heads up display. And you'd assume, if it's in phones, then yeah, you can realistically make something that really has that sing. I think what is amazing is beyond the that Google Glass demo where he jumped out of the plane, really what we might have and in greater and more fantastic results is that first Google Glass demo that they released with the single day in New York where, you know, some unbearable hipster is communicating with people and taking pictures and has a little Google Hangout thing open up where, you know, like something like this. Now, I mean, that was a vision, 5 years ago now, 6 years ago?
Yeah, it feels ancient.
But it's, you know, it's funny because you look at that, you look at the demo too, and the demo is a lie because they show this in the middle of your field of vision. They show you this sort of, you know, like, oh, I'm looking this at this in front of me kind of thing.
Yeah. And so this was absolute science fiction compared to what was actually released, right?
Yeah.
And yet this, I think now, especially with that AR kit stuff, I mean, you can say you can make this a lot more visually interesting. And your abilities here are just are awesome.
Yeah, it's
wow,
maybe
what a
finally.
Fraudulent demo. I haven't seen this in a while. This was so fraudulent.
Well, I mean, what's funny is, yes, it was fraudulent for the product that was delivered in a generation first, you know, situation. But it's not, to be honest, it's a bit like reading Snow Crash. Everything in Snow Crash was already physically possible. It was just a matter of resources and, you know.
But he was selling us a book. He wasn't selling us a product, and they sold these things.
No, well, that's true. That's true. They were presenting this as though this was your experience wearing the device.
But in time, Google services have themselves met up with this demo. You're seeing them do more interior mapping, sharing location data, a better, you know, hyper-local data.
In fact, my
user interface is
my Google
right.
app just hit me up over the weekend saying, hey, can I pretty please download 20 megabytes of local data? Mm-hmm. I've been watching where you hang out.
Oh, wow.
And it'd be better if I didn't constantly have to download it from the internet, so let me just give it to you. And I'm like, yeah, of course, let's go.
I mean, just even the fact that it's in color, when the actual Google Glass product was in black and white, it was, you know, in this tiny little perma gray box in your field of vision that then would come alive periodically. I think that I would not doubt if we get something from Apple that can actually deliver on what that demo is in an even more visually interesting kind of way.
All right, gentlemen, we have a choice here. We can go to the future. We can go to the past.
Past.
For a
past.
Story. Past.
To the past.
So the story you declined was actually Skeptic Magazine. There's the head article is a criticism of the idea that we're all in a simulation.
Future. Let's go to the future. Let's talk about whether or not we're in a simulation.
I don't want to. It's a guy by the name of Kassan who I highly recommend. If you go to Skeptic Magazine, go to online, you can read it. Read it if you want. Then read the criticisms of it. It was one of these things where you're like, I'm like, oh, I'm, it's like, you know, we're not. The premise is we're not living in a simulation. And it's like, all right, let's read this. And he starts off with a description of like, here's the argument that we're living in a simulation. That you know,
he does a poor job of representing the other side.
And that's one of the many problems. You know, it's this, oh, that like, you know, Earth has life and there may be other planets like Earth. And then if there's other planets like Earth, maybe they'll have life that can develop computers and blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, we don't need to have Earth-like planets to have life. We don't need to have them to have computers. And also the idea is that, you know, it kind of like if you in a universe that's going to last a trillion years, are you saying that nobody else will ever come up and have computers? You know, like I'm bearish on the idea that there's other intelligent life out there, you know, than our galaxy. I'm not so inclined to think that that's maybe likely to be true. I don't know that it's true. But if you ask me in the trillion year history of our universe, the future history of the universe, are we never going to have intelligent life on par or greater than us? I'm not going to take that bet, you know. So that whole first part of his argument is sort of based on like it's if you're some assuming we're in the you know we're in the simulation, we don't know when it started. So it starts off with a sort of very narrow definition of this sort of thing to say to make it look kind of unlikely. And then he gets into this, says that
real quick, just for those new listeners, You know, we're speaking about one of the theories that was not postulated by, but popularized by Elon Musk, the idea that, you know, and of course, this is a super old theory. Descartes had
brain
it
in the vat.
And he thought it was we're just a brain in a vat. The idea that which is more likely, that we're actually in the only real universe that there is, or that we're in one of millions of simulations of universes.
Mm-hmm. And the argument as presented is I used to use this in a, and it's a very, very old example. And it's been, you know, lately Nick Bostrom's talked a lot about this, but I mean, this goes way back to, you know, like, into the, you know, Enlightenment period, talking about a demon trying to construct a reality sort of stuff. And the argument that I would give is that, like, well, if it's, you know, if you can develop a computer that can recreate your life, you know, reality, and there may be other, other civilizations develop computers, and they can develop realities as complex, realistic as their own, and they could have a near infinite number of these, what's the likelihood we're in a real reality or in a fake one? And it would seem like awfully likely we're in a simulated reality based upon those assumptions. And the argument says these are assumptions, and you have to say which assumption falls apart. And he sort of says, I don't think it's likely that anybody else is ever going to develop computers. I don't think it really falls apart there. In a trillion-year history of the universe, we're so effing special then, which is really weird. I don't, you know, I think there's a degree. But anyhow, he then says, well, here's the problem. He says that, according to this argument, you know, there's no way to know if this is true or not, so it's not even empirical, it's not even science, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, well, he said that. The people making the argument haven't said that, that said that there's no way to know. And I had a problem with that assumption in his critique was, we don't know that there's no way to know. And scientific inquiry starts with a question. The question doesn't have to have any basis on fact or anything. Science is not a set of facts. Science is a process. And you start somewhere in the process. It's like you have a hypothesis. You know, you have a thing like an observation hypothesis. What if this is true? And there are many things that at the time we had no way of knowing how we could test these things that later on we could test them. The Big Bang, the idea that the universe started at some point, that later on we'd actually be able to measure it, observe it, which we do now. Crazy, crazy, but we do that. So, and we have, there are ideas on how you could tell if it's a simulation. You'd look for little artifacts, you know, as far as, you know, data compression things, all this sort of things. There's a lot of ideas on how to test this thing. So it's this weird, it was a very weird straw man argument, you know, of this is, you know, likely so. And then he gets into this weird sort of idea of talking about how, like, brains aren't computers because brains don't process. And it was just this very, and I went back and read an article he wrote 10 years ago about artificial intelligence, how it's just sort of fallen short and it's just not going to deliver. And it's sort of this, you know, kind of BS. And I'm sitting here thinking, like, I have machine learning on my phone, you know, computers beat us at Go. Computers can recognize images not based upon, and it was a very weird, narrow definition of image processing. You know, it's like it can recognize one photo and then tell you what it looks like from a different angle there. It's AI is doing really well. So,
yeah, sure.
Anyhow, point is, it's worth reading than reading the discussions there, but I think, are we sort of all on the same page? Like, yeah, you know, could be true.
No. I would say we're not. I would say of the three of us, I'm the most skeptical that this is the actual reality that we live in.
So you're fully on board. This is, I'm sorry, suckers, you know.
No, I'm fully on board would imply that I had a less reasoned position. I'm going to say, all things being equal, I understand very much the argument like, oh wait, you're just saying that out of all of humanity or out of all of the universe, I just happen to get created and I just happen to be, and I happen to be, I happen to be, happen to be, and I happen to be living this life. I deeply understand the speculation that it's like, you know, well, you know, if you're making a bazillion D, you know, fake universes, then it seems like I would be in one of them. So I'm gonna
read you the last two paragraphs then, Brian. I'm gonna get the Brian hot take on this. Right. Yours too, Justin. Okay. And again, it's a weird discussion of computer processing. So this guy's got a background in computing, but it's the danger of using your personal definitions and not the ones that other people agree to, because you can define them in ways that apply to you. But let me read you the last two paragraphs. There's another irony concerning the notion that we're all just computer simulations. If you believe you're living in a computer simulation, then everything you think you know about the world, including its vastness, the probability of intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, and even the very existence of computers, is part of that simulation and is so is completely worthless. The evidence on which
time out. Like immediately when I read that, like that just sounds like Steve Harvey saying, well, the moment someone says they don't believe in God, I just walk away. I don't understand it. That's
the evidence on which the entire chain of reasoning depends, in short, is illusory, and so nothing at all can be argued from it. Next paragraph. Finally, if we believe we're just simulations, how should we behave? Should we treat everyone around us as if they're a figment of someone else's imagination, shamelessly manipulating them for our own pleasure or gain? Should we take careless risks, knowing we'll live again in another simulation after a reboot? Should we even bother to get out of bed, knowing that it was all unreal? I think not. Applying a variation of Pascal's wager, I'll live my life on the assumption that I'm real and so are you.
This is
so
by Peter Casale. I hate everything. I hate every word you just spoke.
Hey, not my words.
Okay, no. I'm just saying I hate the words that were spoken in that order with the meaning that they conveyed.
Brian, 100% on board with you. 100% on board with you.
Here's the thing is whether God is an alien in a different dimension that caused two brains to smash together and cause the Big Bang, whether it was random accident that happened, whether I am in reality or whether I am in a simulation, my life is defined by me being born, absorbing as much information as I can about all the links of the chain that came before me, and by trying to do the most good that will be remembered by the most links in the chain ahead of me. That is all I am, no matter what reality is around me. And this infantile argument that, oh, well, if it's a simulation, let's just kill each other, is the same argument as, oh, if there's no God, let's just kill each other, is the same argument as, and I hate all of it. I hate all of it because it's clear that assuming that you know we have a real handle on real society, it is true that everybody inherently wants to contribute and be remembered down the chain of history, just like I do. And I think
inherently there are two people that, and I'm going to say this sentence, and I don't mean to attack the publication, but there are two people that read Skeptic magazine. Or find themselves in a skeptic community as defined by that.
And older white men.
Who are obsessed with questions or people who are obsessed with answers. And what has frustrated me the most, and what if I dare say this podcast tries to be important, it is because we all believe more in the questions than the answers. We all find far more fascinating the questions and the answers, and only try to suss out certain things to ask better questions, as opposed to planting our flag in where we believe by way of science. The answer is all right. Nothing more to see here, and that's what I loathe about that kind of argument. And when we're not looking at it as saying, hey, look, here's this fascinating idea. And obviously it has such a relevance in our popular culture. It has such a relevance in kind of our philosophy. So let's explore it and explore where people come from. And by that, honor everybody's thoughts coming to it and kind of leave it open-ended, as opposed to just saying, well, look at this. I took a good hard look at this. And by science, it's not true. Move along, folks.
It's frustrating because I when I find myself in discussions, I try to clarify, like, okay, if it's a religious discussion, I'm like, well, if it's a religious discussion, and by definition, meaning the evidence of that is faith-based and not evidence-based, then I don't have anything to contribute to that. You know, I can say that if you believe that, you know, your reality is any evidence or whatever is contrary to that, then that's fine. You know, I can't tell you that you are wrong because you're right to believe whatever you choose. If you say that, no, there is evidence that supports this, then we can talk about the evidence. In a case like this, if, you know, he tries to short circuit the entire argument, like, hey, there's no way to support this evidence, so it's not worth discussing. Well, worth is a subjective personal value. It may be not worth for you, and it might be there could be, you know, some larger ramifications of that. There could be things that can be inferred from stuff. So it's my problem. People try to short circuit it like, yeah, no, sorry, because it's like, I don't know that you can't test it or whatever. And maybe you can't. But is it helpful to say, hey, here is a logical possibility. What does that mean? What does it mean if there is this thing? And so there are a lot of interesting assumptions that can be made from there. So, I think your assessment, Justin, it's either people want questions or they want answers. And people who are in seek, you know, I remember when you're a kid in your school and they talk about like scientific laws, and laws were very confusing because you'd ask like, when does something else become a law? And you're, yeah. As you're a kid, you want certainty. You want certainty. You want answers. You want to know that this is a fact and this is not going to
change.
Then
all of a sudden an atom would show up, like an animated neutron, and he's just like, I'm just an idea, a little idea, but I'm hoping to become a law.
And you know, it takes a long way to sort of get to the point where you understand. And many people who are very, very pro science do not understand this: is that you never real science. You never get 100% certainty. You get likelihood. This is more likely than something else to be true. Law of gravity, Einstein, all this stuff. Man, I would be shocked if any of that ever got overturned. Absolutely shocked. But we can't say that it could never get overturned because that's not a scientific premise.
Sure.
That's not a, you know, and that's when, man, when I hear people say things, well, this is a fact, you can't argue it, whatever. And they're talking, it's like, you just stepped away from, you know, I hear science, like you stepped out of science into religion right there. And you could be right, but that ain't science.
To be more generous, let's say you move from physics to metaphysics, right? You moved into postulates that can never be proved one way or the other, which is a fine philosophy, right? Religion among a certain subsection of the populace has a stigma attached to it, whereas philosophy, I think, is universal.
Well, I would parse it more and say that as my definition of it, getting into areas in which you do not acquire or cannot provide evidence to say that it is like that is true. That's why I use it. You're in the realm of the supernatural or religious. You're saying this is a fact. How do we? We don't. We can't know. We can't say that this is 100% absolute fact. That's a religious argument. That's my claim.
I think even after your clarification, I think I would double down on those. These are not religious, but they are philosophical questions.
Fight. Why would they were fight? Fight. Religion versus philosophy. Go. Fight it.
Philosophical is a very large encompassing area, and I would say a subset of that can be religious. I would say that a religious statement to me is something that I say that I have no evidence support it. I have no evidence support it, but I believe this to be true. And if I'm stating it's emphatically true without evidence, to me, and that's how I parse these things. I go, right. That's a religious belief. Does not mean that it is wrong. It does not believe that it's wrong. It's right. A faith-based belief, you know, and you can believe things to be true without evidence, and they can be true, or the evidence can support them to be true.
Man,
but
I don't think until this moment I had ever considered religion as a subsection of philosophy. But now that I'm trying it on for size, that seems fundamentally true, because philosophy is the general discussion of, you know, we'll say moral rights and wrongs, but also about the nature of humanity and what our place is. And you're right. Religion is a subsection in which a supernatural event is ascribed to. I don't know. You might have blown my mind. I might need a bit to think about this.
No worries. I mean, we all need to ask these questions about this. So Bryce pulled up the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, the philosophical examination of the central themes and concepts involved in religious traditions. And religion is, you know, and these are amorphous terms. They can be very amorphous terms, and that's one of the problems. I remember the great, you know, atheist agnostic debates, and I'm like, well, what does it mean? What does the word mean before we get into is this that or is that? And if we can't agree on what that word means, then we're not really going to be useful. We're not going to have a useful discussion of categorization. And I would point out in the historically atheist meant anybody who did not believe in your religion, because if you believed in the wrong God, it's a false God, i.e. no God. And I get up and be like, no. I'm like, well, now we're getting into personal definitions, and there might be ones we largely agree upon, but so many misconceptions come across because capitalism, you know, that's a great one. What does that mean? If your personal definition of capitalism is different than mine, you know, oh, capitalism, where the rich people going to control everything. Well, geez, I don't like that, you know.
Well, and in fact, I remember in my 20s having a series of philosophical discussions of this very nature with a friend of ours both of us were talking about the same subjects and oftentimes agreeing or oftentimes disagreeing, but always asking questions the entire time. And at the end of our discussion, it was clear to me we had just spent, you know, 45 minutes asking questions about the nature of, you know, Christianic law. And well, clearly we were both agnostics because we were seeking an answer but did not have one yet. And then so when I qualified him as one, he found that offensive. He's like, whoa, no, I'm a Christian. And then, but then I realized through his point of view, like, of course, yeah, a Christian can also ask questions and be trying to figure out where to go next. So I don't know. Words are dumb. The sooner we can build robots to just, you know, infuse each other with our meaning, that would be better.
Well, who decides the meaning, man? That's the thing is I look at so many disagreements people have with each other is, one, not understanding somebody else's theory of mind, but two is we're working through different vocabularies.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'll bring this up here and I want to get political, but I heard I've heard the expression again as at a party. Somebody said people voting against their own best interests. And I'm like, all right, we got to unpack that because there's so many assumptions in that statement. In that, one is that you know what their self-interests are, that the act of voting against what you perceive that to be is the same as you vote for it, you would get this thing. You know, that saying that if you vote this way, I will give you the thing is not the same as voting for this thing and getting a thing.
I found myself my oldest, Penelope, is 13 years old now, and she's at the point where she's thinking big thoughts, big ideas, and she's really having a problem with why would you ever vote against your interests, so to speak, right? Where it's like, if you believe that the world is going to end on Tuesday because Space Monkey is barreling towards us at a million light years per second, then it would be obvious to you that everybody needs to build a Space Monkey shield. And anybody who doesn't vote for that is clearly insane and needs to be fixed, right? And I try to explain to her, and these are all allegories for very real political issues, but I don't want to make it political. I try to explain to her that that the human race is a stronger race because of our heterogeneity, because of the fact that our genes keep constantly swapping details between each other, and that we don't just simply clone. If you are a single mind designing a society to procreate wildly, you would basically make bacteria. They duplicate instantly. They within 20 minutes, the whole world's covered by them. They're clearly the best way to go. But what you fail to comprehend is, or to wrap your mind around in advance, is all of the ideas that have yet to be invented yet, all the thoughts or problems that have yet to be discovered. And as a result, if you think of a culture like a small village as an organism, then you realize that, yes, 90% let's go out, kill meat, it'll be there every week is a good thing to do. 10% crazy person that nobody likes. 10% insane ideas, black as white, night as day, or whatever. It turns out that's healthy to have as part of it because things might not always be the way they are right now. And the example I give to Penny was like, you know, hey, man, you and I probably would not be interested in having in our neighborhood somebody who was constantly, you know, threatening to shoot people who crossed his property, who, you know, was constantly firing off guns and doing all this other stuff. And I said, and yet, you know, the moment an asteroid hits the planet and a third of the planet dies, this is a great conversation to have with your 13-year-old, by the way. The moment that happens, I'm suddenly really glad that guy lives in my neighborhood and is part of my body politic, my organism. And so likewise, I guess I was trying to make the case to her that that's how it is with ideas, that you can fundamentally disagree with the tenets of the Ku Klux Klan, but yet also say it is deeply important that they have the right to say exactly what they think forever.
Mm-hmm. I would narrow back to the space monkey thing. My argument would be like, hey, well, the person who told us space monkey is coming, they are sincere, but one, they are a person. People make mistakes. Two, this person's made mistakes before and has been imprecise about dangers of this. Three, this person, I realize they don't understand the impact of the thing they're asking us to do to prepare for Space Monkey. They say we need to go to the hills or go do this sort of thing, and they've underestimated the cost of doing that. There is maybe likelihood that Space Monkey won't be as bad as we think. And if we do the thing they told us to, you know, to prevent Space Monkey, we may be at a greater loss than if we do nothing. Not at all drawn into parallel to anything else.
Would it be safe to postulate that if any issue appears to you to be black and white, then that alone might merit that you almost certainly misunderstand it?
Yeah, I think
you know, this is where we get into like, okay, so like pedophilia or murder or something like that. There are elements in which societally we've made some fairly hard and fast.
Well, let's break those down though. Let's break the, so we
one
we
go, episode, man. We're gonna fix it all. Let's do this.
Well,
let's go.
Because I would say like we had initially say like murder bad. Okay, are soldiers bad?
Right.
Well, no. We'd say because that's a condition. We have to define that. We have to.
Sure. And the idea is theoretically our guiding moral principles on war are we have wars to prevent more murder, right? That we are intervening or interdicting to the core principle that murder bad even allows murder.
Well, that's just it. That's why we have to, it's not black. We have to go gray. Like, is murder bad? Well, what kind of murder? You know, and that's where you have to disturb it. And the other issue, which I don't even want to touch, is what was acceptable, and I don't think appropriately so, 30 years ago, 50 years ago. You read about some of these rock stars, you know, in the 70s and what their behavior was. You're like, oh, my God, they'd be doing 30 years in jail today for what they did. Mm-hmm. And that was a shifting line of what people thought was acceptable versus not. And I think that in some cases, as we've learned to respect people's rights and agency, part of what we also have to do is respect that we need to protect you until you're a certain age because it's very easy for you to be taken advantage of. That's shifted considerably, you know, you know, and that's a thing where you get into, you know, a thing that, you know, where I'm comfortable. We define those lines as, you know, as safely as we can to protect people from their own, you know, actions and whatever and being victimization of stuff. But I understand historically that's been different. And I'm not saying it was, you know, and some people are like, and therefore it's better. I'm like, no, we really didn't have a lot of respect for people in the past. We're actually much better.
Well,
at
and
it
also
now.
a lot of that is human timeline related, mm-hmm. right? Like as we've lived longer, the idea of childhood historically has become this different thing. Mm-hmm. And it has become a thing that I think we now have the luxury of protecting in a way that, you know, historically was not quite the case always.
Yeah. I mean, that certainly changed. So I think that, you know, often you can say these things, they may be gray, but ultimately the answers are black and white, but you have to parse them and say, okay, let's break this down and look at these conditions. Like, yeah, nope, still wrong. Yep, that's still wrong. Yep, that's still wrong. But yeah, when somebody says a big issue, it's like, whenever somebody says, it's very easy. If you're not this, whatever, you know, I'm like, it's dogma. And dogmas can sometimes be right, but you know, it's not critical thinking. Critical thinking is understanding what, you know, where the evidence comes from. And how you process.
I think, and that's, you know, ultimately where, I mean, since we can dance around it, but also it's like where things can get disheartening, and I don't know if the echo chamber of social media, which everybody kind of always wants to sort of turn into, is very micro, and we want to turn it into the macro. If that is all right, the disheartening element about it is that we seem to feel that we see more and more of people kind of tuning out of like, well, if you are blank, then I can never talk to you again. Right.
Yeah.
And if you are this, then this is now, you are now a poison seed. And now anytime that anybody does anything, I will live to remind everybody that you are a blank. Right.
Mm.
And that is sad to see, but ultimately, I don't know. My guiding faith in the internet is that we, even as the ugliness plays out in front of us, that we are becoming more aware of our humanity as opposed to less, even if we're in a very awkward, weird puberty stage with it.
I have a weird theory that even when anybody disagrees with me, I suspect that nobody disagrees. I suspect that just language is dumb and stupid and a poor proxy for the thoughts that we're having. I feel like every disagreement I've ever had really boils down to, if I imagine a sideways splinter universe in which we spent 100 years explaining everything and why we, deconstructing, well, why do you think this? And why do you think that? Why do you think that? I just feel like you end up at one of two results. Either the data I've observed up until this point differs from yours. That's why I think if you make this political decision, a riot will explode, is because I've seen that 100 times before. Or you have, I guess inherently, I'm slightly more suspicious than you, which would be a genetic thing. So in other words, like, it boils down to, the whole nature versus nurture debate. The answer, of course, turns out to be yes to both. At some point, you can point to every disagreement and say, there are really only three possibilities. Either language is dumb and you're not understanding each other. But if you are understanding each other, there's only two reasons you would disagree. One is because you're genetically different. Two is because you've had fundamentally different inputs in your lifetime up until this point. I mean, does that cover everything, Andrew?
I mean, you get into a very troublesome area, though, where you have people who have similarly the same data sets and very similar backgrounds who arrive at very different conclusions. And well, I think you get into core things.
That one I write down as genetics, but. Unless there's
maybe
something else.
I mean, I don't that's sort of a, I mean, we could start doing twin studies then on political beliefs, I mean, I don't think it's actually genetics, because I don't have an answer to that, but I will say that when I get in discussions with people, I find that the core thing comes down to, it's either top down or bottom up. It's either we need the smart people to tell everybody else how they need to live. Or given in a democracy and not letting the mob rule, whatever. I had a discussion with somebody who was very influential person about the whole, like, people voting against their best interest sort of thing. Cause to me, that just sounds so elitist. It's this, we know what's right for them. And that is, that belief is just, it is the examples of leading to catastrophic failure are tremendous. And I just sort of, when I hear an intelligent person say this, I kind of, I'm like, okay. But I was sort of a guy. I said, well, I mentioned, you should check out a great book. There's, Wisdom of the Crowds by Sir Wiki, which he goes, oh, like the mob, the angry. I'm like, no,
Yeah, that's like, not quite.
Yeah, it's like, no, it's the opposite. It's how individually acting in our own self-interest. Overall, we tend to make very good decisions overall. And you may not think this at the moment. He's like, it was just weird. You go like, oh, well, like, what about, Southerners in, the Civil War who voted against, you wanted to go to war? I'm like, all right, you have to go. You're going back the 150 years for historical example, out of context. And
But even if we allow that to be inbound, you could theoretically make a case for somebody who.
Well, I did take the argument apart afterwards.
Okay. No, I believe you did. But like, even then, I can imagine making the case of like, let's say whatever the issue was, like this person was voting against their own self-interest. They knew that their plot would be the first to be ravaged. They knew that they had everything to lose. They also didn't particularly care about slavery. They thought maybe all their slaves should be free or whatever. But you could make a case that the meta organization of loyalty based by mm-hmm. geographic familiarity has a benefit to society, and that's why somebody would operate for that.
Yeah, you get into a lot of a lot of reasons to say that why would these things happen or whatever, and it's this sort of like, are you asking why people individually or why as a group did they do that? But also, there was. Economically, it was ended up not being in their best interest because the retributions from the North for the war lasted, a century and had a major impact on political parties, the Southern, the Dixiecrat, whatever, And so it's one of these things like, yes, we can parse these things, but we can. And like I'm very much a bottom up. I'm very much a information system. I believe in evolution. I believe in the ideas at which, where ideas and emergence come from. I believe in how that is. These are things all relate together for me. And I would, if you said, hey, if Space Monkey is coming right now, all the telescopes have spotted this, should we allow our president to declare martial law to try to save things or to handle this? I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to argue against that right now. I'm like, the evidence is that strong right now. Maybe we need top down for a moment, but a conditional temporary sort of thing, but not for all the time.
You know what? That's a really good point. It seems like bottom up is in general the best strategy, with the exception.
Let's just break that down for everybody too when we talk about bottom up. Because
sure. Millions of self interest.
Because people are having these discussions. So you are drinking bottoms up.
Yes, correct. Millions and billions of people, each individually motivated by their own self-interest, in general, will seem to have elevated humanity to the best, brightest, healthiest, happiest, longest-lived version of us of all time. But top-down is a good insurance policy against a black swan event, which is, if we're going to mix metaphors and bring in another book, the black swan is basically like you could watch, you could check out 10,000 swans, and if they're all white, you still can't confidently declare that there's no such thing as a black swan, because sooner or later you're going to see one, and that's that. And in fact, Nassim Taleb has opened, has made money with financial instruments based on sooner or later there's going to be a black swan event like a 2001, something that everybody agrees. They'll all shrug their shoulders and say nobody could have seen this coming, and they'll apologize to all their investors or whatever. It seems like bottom up yields a day-to-day tiny increase in overall value, but there's no defense from bottom up against a black swan event the way there might be with a top down hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. It's frustrating, because I use this example. I'm going to get political for a moment because we talk about this, and examples are we talk about socialism as an example of a top down things, and you could say like, well, what about it? Sometimes people socialism, they just seem like, what about me giving people this benefit, healthcare, whatever? Like it's bigger than that. It's more than that, and that's a separate discussion of that. And you might have a overall market economy. They can have that. I don't think that's necessarily going to give people what they think it's going to give them. But I'm going to just table that for a moment. Let's take that off the discussion. We talk about socialism, which socialism in the sense of the people we elect decide prices, they decide contracts, they decide all that sort of thing, which is the increasing form of it. We keep running these experiments of testing these things. And the most painful example is you had Venezuela, which was a country which had problems because you had a rich class that had the money, had to control the government, and you had a poor class that was just improving with sort of on par with other third world sort of countries, but not in a dramatic way. And they saw the disparity. There was a growing income disparity between the poor and the rich. Okay. No matter the poor were doing better than they were before, the disparity was growing, and it's problematic because it was a highly corrupt system. So revolution, elections, Hugo Chavez comes to power. He tried to overthrow, then he got elected to power. Hugo Chavez comes to power and embarks upon this socialist, plan. And again, we're not talking about like health. We're talking about big, sweeping control, nationalize oil, nationalize this, take over, all this sort of stuff. people in the West, intellectuals, you know, in New York Times, whatever, people who you read who still have columns today talked about this Venezuelan miracle, because for a period of time, there is this little bit of a boom, but also kind of tied with the fact that oil prices were dramatically increasing for a period, okay?
Well, and also from what I understand, there tends to be any time a cultural shift towards socialism or communism, there is this hormonal wave of let's do it, let's all work really hard, this might work. And as at the beginning of any new endeavor, everybody pitches in, you know, to the peak of their capacity.
Well, when we all go raid the rich guy's house in the neighborhood, for the moment, we're all momentarily more wealthy. And then when we go back there and we find out the house is empty, then we're not. So what happened was, we can get into the reasons why, you know, why he was elected, whatever. And I understand, and I'm not like faulting people for thinking, you know, we need a change, whatever. Not at all. But anyhow, here we are, almost 20 years later from when that happened, 20 years later from when he was elected, and Venezuela has one of the poorest economies in the world. Venezuela has suffered tremendously. Now, the people, Maduro, the people running it are like, oh, what's bad luck, bad luck, bad luck. Okay. That always is the explanation when countries turn more socialist and things fall apart, okay? Now, meanwhile, you take China. China was extremely socialist. China is now, from economic, there are some longer term problems, all that, but from where China was over that period of time 20 years ago and where Venezuela was, China is now average Chinese citizens, much more wealthy, much more productive. China is becoming an incredibly successful country. There are problems there. Let me make that clear. But as far as its economic output, its GDP increased dramatically. Did it get there becoming more socialist or less socialist? And right. Well, they became more free market when it came to things. And so, was that a coincidence?
All right. Well, first of all, I don't think you're going to hear any disagreement here. No. But also, I don't want to lose anybody who thinks this is political things. I agree. The whole top-down, bottom-up dynamic is fascinating to me.
Well, I mean, and that's the whole point, is just getting into like where – and I'm not going to back down and say, I'm sorry if I offend you. Like, no, I'm going to say that's the problem with a top-down mentality, is that we've seen it's killing people. People are dying in Venezuela. There are hospitals that can't afford medications. They can't afford to do this because of the system. And it happens because I'm not going to get into one party or the other, because whenever in our country, when either party comes into power, they then try to become top down. They do try to become top down. So I'm not going to say like, therefore vote for these people. I'm like, not at all. Because once you're in power, you control, you exert power in our country by how you decide how you're going to spend money. You get Republican senators who do this. You get Democratic senators who do this. And they may espouse these things. You know, you had Paul Ryan was talking about, you know, reading, you know, Atlas Shrugged or quoting all sorts of stuff. Doesn't do it anymore, you know? So
well, yeah, kind of gets into the other element, which is there is a difference between political speech and actual dialogue, and I think that if there's anything that frustrates me on a daily basis is that we very often think that the dialogue is just retweeting somebody who is either in out and out advocacy for something or is a politician, that their job is to get elected, not to lead responsible or beneficial dialogues in our country.
Well, you get into the system and you have to be part of it. And I don't, and I you know, I, and that's the thing. And I don't, I would fault, but I don't understand. And I was like, J.C. Calhoun says, sadly, for real socialism to work, it would take a lot of inculcation for people not to work against it. What does real socialism mean? What does that really mean? And I think I would say that is my argument coming back from just an information theory thing. And the real version of this means that a group distributes information, distributes resources based upon what they believe the needs to be. You have a fundamental information problem. It's, to me, that's magic. You know, it's the ministry of magic. I don't believe that that's the case. I think it just, it's like, you know, fast.
And look
travel.
How well that worked out. I saw those movies. Ministry of Magic wasn't without their problems.
Man, Mad Eye Moody was saying, like, I hear some Andrew Mayne throwing some shade my way.
I went into, you know, when I did my book, Blackfall, my latest Jessica Blackwood book, one of the sort of the themes that I went into there was just this subtle theme. And there was just the historical effort we've tried to make to control things, and it's not one party or the other is more or less guilty, but they all have the certain things they try it a way they want to do it. You know, you may have, you know, you can have conservatives internationally, they try to use military power to try to influence the way of the events in the world and sort of apply this top down. We will change this thing here. We're sure it'll work this time. And sometimes it does. Sometimes it doesn't. Whether or not it's related to our intervention or not depends on the condition. You liberals tend to have this idea of how we apply it domestically, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just I don't want to offend anybody. I just, you know, may offend everybody.
Hey, man, I'm assuming we don't have time to quite go into Journey Quest this week, right?
We'll do that next week because you're going to find out what UGG really is.
Yeah, I'm very excited. But in the meantime, for picks, can I go first?
Sure, yeah.
Took a while to get there. Took a while to get there, people, but I'm finally reading Andrew Main's Station Breaker on audible.com. It's fantastically read, very easy to get into. It is concrete and action-packed, and I'm enjoying it more than I ever dared hope. My favorite part, though, is the interactive aspect of the audiobook, in which the author of the audiobook repeatedly texts you, and you have a conversation with the author. For example, this conversation when the author of Station Breaker texted me a link to the Audible of the sequel of the book, and I said, "Oh, S word, awesome!" Again, loving Station Breaker, and then the author, one Andrew Main, writes, "It's a book I basically wrote for you and me." which if you think that doesn't significantly color your reading of the book, when the author writes you and says, I wrote this book
for us.
Yes, it's making it so much fun. And I'm really excited to plow through the rest of this and then go on to Orbital.
Thank you very much. Yeah, Orbital just dropped in audiobook format too. So Orbital's there. These books are, I get questions like, what should I write? I'm like, you know, write what you want to read, you know, start there and write what you want to read that other people might want to read. And this was Station Breaker was a book that like, man, I want to write a really cool near term. It's a hard genre because I'm like, I'm not writing far off sci-fi. It's not aliens, but it's this sort of shorter term kind of thing.
I really do like the fact that you did a preface that very clearly set the stage for this. You said, everything you're about to read is either in late stages of development or already exists. This is a book set in the very near future. And I love the concreteness followed by the ambiguity, because the concreteness is this all exists very soon, but the ambiguity is like, well, how soon is very soon? And I like that everybody's able to define that for themselves.
Yeah, it could be 5, it could be 15 years, you know, and it's a fast approaching sort of thing. So Orbital gets a little bit further. Orbital involves a space station, you know, rotating space station sort of thing. And it takes place right around that period. I mean, it starts off right where Station Breaker ends. People are like, anyhow, point is.
Read Station Breaker first and then jump into Orbital. same reader for the second book.
Yeah. He did a great job.
Have you, how does that go? Like behind the scenes, you guys chit chat a little bit. You're like,
oh yeah, he was great. So, Kyle McCartley. So what he would do is, you know, first it was like, Tantor, just to give backstory. So I wrote Station Breaker just on my own. I self published it. Then Tantor Audio came along and said, hey, you know, we'd like to buy the audiobook rights to this. I'm like, great. Called up my agent. I'm like, hey, I wrote a book, by the way, and I, you know, never asked you to sell it. I just did it for fun. And now people want to buy the audiobook rights. So they went in and they said, okay, we'll do the audio version for it. And they gave me several different narrators. All were really good, but said, you know, first round, I'm like, yeah, but I said, this guy's in his, you know, his late 20s. So these people sound older. They came back. And Kyle was one of the recommendations I did. And I went to Kyle's page for listen to his other loops. And I'm like, saw some of the stuff, listened to some of the stuff. This is fantastic. This guy's got the voice. So this guy could absolutely do it. So they had him do it. And then Kyle would reach out to me and be like, he found like a couple mistakes too. Like, hey, you have this character named this here. And I think it changes there. I'm like, oh, this is what I meant. He's like, how do you pronounce this? I'm like, I don't really know. And then I would, you know, I'd record my versions of it and send it back and forth. I'd be like, you know, I made this up, right?
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, like, it's not the real world. It's not a biography. Please, lay off.
But he was very, very proactive and good about that. And I tried to give him answers as quickly as I could. And so, because at that time I had two other audiobooks in development. It was sort of a weird thing to be back and forth with different narrators or people like this. You know, so dealing with him was great.
you're like, all of you, stop reading my books and criticizing me. Stop it.
it's you know, it's that sometimes I'll be reading like an editor's notes on something and I'm like, I made this. Like, we tried to find out the answer for such and such such thing. Can you provide us an example? I'm like, I made it up, you know? Blackfall opens up with a quote like, oh, we can't find this. I said, well, if I told you who actually said this, people are going to think it's a very political book. So I'm not going to tell you who said this. because I don't want it to fall into some sort of partisanship thing, which is not my point. Right. So anyhow, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. I'm looking forward to, I started on the third one, haven't finished it yet, but the third one, I'm introducing all these cool things we talk about from like, you know, reusable rockets. Third one gets into deep sky stations, you know, that we've talked about before. And sure. So, you know, just I want to introduce people to, if you want to get an idea of like what the future, what technology is out there and being developed, this is what it's about. It's about that. I'm not inventing anything new. I may be extrapolating stuff. And I try to get my science really, really, really good. I've not had, and I'm sure there are mistakes in there, but I've not had anybody who's been critical of my physics or anything. I've tried to do a very diligent job of that because, you know, I had a frustrating experience with an extremely popular science fiction book that everybody loves and rightfully so. But I'm like, man, this is not right. And I don't want to be the one that says this is not right. I am
talking,
of course, about
J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yes.
Yeah. Eat it.
I was gonna go for the novelization of Poltergeist. So that is fun, and thank you. I have my pick.
Yeah.
What's that?
And I just one more thing about Station Break and Orbital is that sometimes you do something for fun, you put it out there, you look at how many, like, the reviews for Station Break have been fantastic.
I could not believe it, man. 5 stars showing up. I could not find, it's not an invitation, but
sure, there are
less than 3.
Yeah, they're, I'm sure they're gonna be in there.
No, this is a real a triumph. And if you listen to this podcast, this is a book that is written for you. A lot of these themes, a lot of the stuff.
No, the author told me it was written for me. It was written for me. He said me and you. He said the two of us.
Ryan. But so if you like Brian, then don't worry. He had a book written for him. Please make sure that you reply him on Twitter and say, I read your book. And
literally Brian's one of the voices in my head. Well, like, what about this?
Yeah.
What about this? Right, Brian, in my head. Well, okay.
And there totally would be, like, as I'm listening to it, I'm just like, well, what about, oh, yeah, no, that does fix that.
I will say this. Station Breaker, having read a lot of Andrew's books, is probably the most end-to-end, like, no breaths, complete action story that I have read of his. So if you like that, it is... it is certainly in no moment are you like, oh, and here's the part where they take a break. Like, it is about as adrenaline fueled as you can go.
Yeah. I wanted to do the most crazy chase. You know, I thought, like, what are the genres of which, like, science fiction, what are the genres? I'm like, well, you know, action chase. And I said, well, let me make the most crazy one that starts in space, goes to Earth, and you count the number of vehicles he steals. And I don't know if you realize
I'm not that far along. However, I did enjoy explaining to Bonnie, like, hey, did you read The Martian? Okay, remember how the whole world got together to try to help Mark Watney? What if the whole world thought Mark Watney was a murderer?
Yeah.
How different would that be?
Yeah. And so,
somebody in the chat during the show asked about the murder jurisdictions on the International Space Station. These themes are explored in fun and colorful detail in Station Breaker.
Yeah, I had to do my research, and it's funny because now you heard about we talked about the Space Corps.
I don't know that we did.
Oh my God, that's a proposal that we're actually going to be starting a Space Corps, like a new wing, a new military.
Okay, no, that's too rich a vein for us to
next week
try to wedge in. That'll be next week for sure. Yeah.
So let's get to my pick. My pick is.
Oh, you got a copy of Action News.
So, there is a I know an indie creator. He's a very creative guy, and he works with a really interesting team of people that are extremely talented. And they tried a little thing on Kickstarter a while ago. They launched a game called The Contender. And The Contender was a very cool game where, you know, you think about apples and oranges or completion games, or apples and apples. I like to make my own versions of these things. And they came up with a really awesome version of that using politics and stuff that was very intelligent in that. And they said, let's take this now and approach news where somebody plays the role of an anchorman. People are given stories. They put them together and they try to come out with sort of the best stories. It is a watching the genesis and evolution of this game has been awesome. I have in my grubby hands, my first test copy of this game, which I'm going to actually open up right in front of you live on the air. But when I first got this, just the packaging, I loved it, like the Polaroid film kind of sort of thing, which your development team here is amazing. And you can get this. You can support this on Kickstarter, which I did, by the way, even though I already have a copy.
A demo copy. Only a demo.
I know. Only demo copy. And it's going to expire. yes. So what I love about this is you guys put so this is, of course, Justin Robert Young and the crew that he worked with there, Teasdale, Megan Fawn over there at Guts and Glory. And it's just it's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful premise. And what I love about this is that it feels very Justin, and that Justin is the arguably the smartest person I know about politics and world events. And watching him take this from an approach of going in this into sort of a deep dive into history and stuff and creating a game that's a fun game that built around these premises and stuff is just a delight. So anyhow, if you're not supporting Action News, I don't want to know you.
Well, thank you so much for the kind words, and I'm very, very proud of where we're at on the design, and you know, for those of you who were not aware, we launched on Friday and funded within 3 hours of launching last time with The Contender. You know, we thought we were hot poop because we funded within 13 hours. To give you context, on Friday on Nerdtacular 2 years ago, we launched, and it was a huge triumph that by the final panel of the day, we had funded. This one we funded before I was off the stage for the first panel.
And by the way, during the recording of this program, you crossed the threshold to double funded now. So congratulations to that.
So now we are at 30,000, and that's something that we kind of obviously had a really slow holiday weekend because everybody was kind of out. So now we are sort of retuning up the band on that. But here's what I would love for people to do is obviously go to actionnewsgame.com. That's the easiest place that you can find a link to get to the Kickstarter, or you're going to search for Action News on Kickstarter. But what we really want to do is continue to create content that will keep people talking about this. And we've done two things to do it. If you go to our Twitter at Contender Game, you will see a new Kickstarter a new Medium article that we wrote, the 10 Kickstarter commandments, after now launching two of them. And we think that they did pretty successful. We'll see where this new one ends up. We have everything. These are the hard and fast rules that you absolutely need to follow. We did and did not follow some of them. And we actually go through that in detail in our new podcast, which is also available on iTunes and the Google Play Store, called If At First You Don't Succeed, a crowdfunding story. This is a weekly look. John and I have been doing this for the last 8 or 9 weeks. So this is fairly deep into our development process, as well as getting everything ready for the Kickstarter. We talked about everything that we were doing on launch week, and we will continue to do this not only throughout the funding, but also really where we wound up eating it last time with The Contender, which is a lot of the decisions on manufacturing and shipping. If I would like to think that if there is somebody that wants to fund something on Kickstarter, this is us totally emptying the knowledge drawer. We are giving you everything that we are doing, and we hope that it is even a two-way street where if somebody watches us making a mistake, please feel free to contact us and let us know. We have
your name is Andrew O'Brien.
We have really tried to make this as open as possible. We are in no way cagey about our numbers. We are in no way protecting our reputations. There is a benefit to having me lived a very public online life where I have discussed things far more embarrassing than business failures. So we hope to bring that transparency to the new show, as well as to these Medium articles that we are writing throughout this experience, because we found out that there was a huge audience for it. And so what we hope is to continue to take advantage of that audience. We will trade attention for numbers throughout this entire process. So go ahead and follow us on Facebook as well as Twitter. Both, you can just search for Contender Game. And other than that, thank you guys so much for supporting it. And we hope to continue to create content, including hopefully we're going to do a test today to do some live streaming live from the set of Action News with all the costuming and accoutrement that would go along with it later today.
Awesome.
I just want to point out another Kickstarter project as an example of something that looks really, really cool, very, very compelling, but didn't have the follow through. But I want to, if I may, just, have you seen Mike Figgis, who is an amazing director, put out a thing called he has a book out with the 36 dramatic situations for cinema. And he came up with a deck of cards, which is a deck of cards where you can go sort through them and pull out a couple cards and come up with a plot, enemy becomes lover, plot revealed, imprisonment, whatever. And it's an amazing little deck of cards. Looks really, really cool. Cause it's based on his book, 36 Dramatic Situations for Cinema, which is, basically taking the premise of a French book written 200 years ago. And saying, hey, let's look at this now and see how these structures have changed. And Figgis, leaving Las Vegas, Time Code, he's an amazing, innovative director. So he launched this Kickstarter campaign, around the same, like about 10 days before you. And there's an example right now. He's laying this out. He shows an enemy loved, abduction, cruelty, and misfortune. So it's like how to put together a plot for something, right? There are people who have done things similar to this, which are kind of cool, but this looked really, really compelling.
Yeah.
Amazingly talented guy, great concept, price is not that bad, it's only at $1,000 funding.
Well, now I feel like we got to fix that because I want this deck of cards.
Well, and it's the problem.
Hey, don't bother about that.
Forget that other project. Kickstarter.
No. In the step one, you go, oh, well, I got to pay for it in pounds.
Oh, geez. Okay. Wow.
So it's because it's a British project. It's like, okay, so it's in pounds and it's this. And you start going through like, man, he's great. Product's great. But this is, what did not work here? Where what you're doing with Action News, by the way, go to what's the website again?
Action News Game.com.
And you see another great product by great people, but also the fact that what they've had to do to push this beyond and take it beyond. It's not just we're great, this is great. You've got to do so much more to make this thing work. You've got to do a lot more to get this thing to work, and that's a thing that people often don't appreciate, and that I appreciate is how much time, energy you're not just putting into this fantastic, great product. How much you're putting into the fact that, like you said, after this, you're going to be doing live stream and you're going to keep pushing and pushing and pushing this out there. That's what it takes, folks. You'll hear stories about famous people or whatever having successful Kickstarters, but then you hear people who don't, and that can help. But the big difference is the push, the push, the push. ActionNewsGame.com.
Well, thank you so much for that. It is something that for me, I know. I don't want to leave anything on the table. You only get a month to push this as hard as you can. We witnessed one of the big things we learned with the Contender is that, man, Kickstarter is a magical world where people love to throw money at you. And that is not always the case past your little window. And we have some internal goals on what we would like to hit. Thankfully, thanks to our super hot start, we are on the way. But what we know we need to do is a lot more than what we've done. And part of that podcast is us kind of discussing step by step, you know, how we want to get there, what we learned to do last time, how we want to do it again. And part of it is just hustling, just working, you know, getting out in front of people.
Yep. Gentlemen, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.